I've always wanted to do that in a room full of library workers and librarians. So thank you for indulging me. I'm Bruce Walsh. I'm the director of University of Regina Press and your host for the evening. And it is so nice to welcome you to such a beautiful space, First Nations University of Canada and Treaty 4 Territory. And I'm very excited to be here. And I'm obviously very excited always to be in a room where there are librarians. As a book publisher, you're some of our favorite people on the planet. And as the publisher of University of Regina Press, we've had some success with the libraries, I'm very happy to say. We launched, it will be 2 years in June. Our first book was Clearing the Plains. Some of you may have heard about it. It went on to win the Governor General's Award in History and become a very big national bestseller. And has in many ways rewritten the history of this area. So it's very exciting to be able to tell that kind of Saskatchewan story. And to prove that we're not just a one-hit wonder, one of our latest books, The Education of Augie Murasty, just hit the national bestseller list as well. And of course, this is a residential school memoir. And if you read it, you really read what that experience was like from the perspective of a child. So that's really quite a powerful book and one we're so proud to be the publisher of. And both of those books are helping fund a new initiative by the press called the First Nations Language Reader Series. On the day we launched the press, I had a young scholar approach me and he said, I'm working with the last living speaker of her language. I don't suppose you'd be interested in a book on that. And I just thought, could there be a more important book to publish, actually? So that was the beginning of a new series. We have Woods Cree, Plains Cree, Soto, Blackfoot, and we have Lillooet coming in the fall. So I hope all the librarians here would take up that series and really kind of bring it into their collections and promote it to their users. It's a really exciting thing for us. So tonight, of course, we're here for the Mary Donaldson Memorial Lecture Series, which was established in 1967. It was named in honor of Saskatchewan's first provincial librarian, Mary Donaldson, and it's been running ever since. She was also the president of the Canadian Library Association, so she was somebody who did great things, not just in the province, but nationally. And so it's wonderful that all these years later, she continues to be honored through this series and other things in her name. The series, there's been many speakers over those years, including Adrian Clarkson and Roche Carrier and Gail Bowen. And tonight we have a very special treat because I think we have the youngest speaker ever for the Mary Donaldson Lecture Series, Gabrielle Scrimshaw. So, but we'll get to that later. First, I would like to introduce our elder, Lillian Piapot, who will come and offer a blessing for us all. Lillian.
Tonight I'm very honored to be praying that things call for everybody to be blessed here. And my spirit name is Dr. Katie Skoka, always in the sky sitting woman.
Thank you so much, Lillian. And of course, Lillian didn't use the mic to say the prayer. Yes. Next, if you're like me, and you would love to sit beside our next speaker at a dinner party, because not only is she Vice President Academic at First Nations University of Canada, she also taught courses in contemporary British fiction, which I love, Salman Rushdie, and the Booker Prize. On top of that, she's written a book by one of my favorite writers, who's Ian McEwan. So ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Lynn Wells.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to First Nations University of Canada. Thank you so much, Elder Lillian, for the opening prayer. Bruce said he was going to talk about my career, and it's been so long, I've kind of forgotten what it was all about, so it was nice to have a refresher there. Welcome to you all. I love doing this when I have people in the building. Can you tell me, for how many people is this your first time in our building? Lots and lots of people. That's wonderful. Well, you're welcome. And as you can see, it's a magnificent building. But I always like to say that the building is just the outer manifestation of the wonderful things inside. This is an amazing institution, and it fits very well with Gabrielle's talk that she will be giving us tonight on Aboriginal leadership and education, because that's what First Nations University of Canada is all about. The Library Association is, of course, very welcome here, and our libraries are a very big part of what we do at First Nations University. I say libraries plural because you may not realize that we in fact have three libraries. Our main library here in Regina, our library in Prince Albert, and a small library at our Saskatoon campus. And all three of those Libraries are connected to the University of Regina system, so we're very fortunate, our students are very fortunate, to have access to one of the best collections of Indigenous literature and knowledge in the country, if not in North America, but they also have access to all of the resources at the University of Regina. We also house a very special collection, and if you want to know more about that, Brendan Edwards, our librarian, and Paula Degla, sitting here, I'm sure would be happy to talk to you about that. I'm really looking forward to tonight's talk. I wish I had more of our students here because I know they would really value hearing from a role model like Gabrielle. It's terrific to have you here, and I hope you enjoy your time here in Regina. Please take some time to look around the building. Our little art gallery is open, and it's always got something beautiful going on. Brendan has offered to take people on a tour of our library space after the talk, and feel free to walk around the building, and if there's anything you would like to learn about First Nations University of Canada, I'd be happy to talk with any of you after the talk. Thanks very much for being here.
So, as well as serving on the peer review board of University of Regina Press and being the provost and vice president academic at University of Regina, Tom Chase began his career, and I love this, as a stock boy at the university bookstore. That speaks to me. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome a man who has enriched both himself and the world with books and ideas, Dr. Tom Chase.
Elder Lillian, it's good to see you. Good evening, everyone. What a beautiful prairie evening it is. If you turn around for a moment, you have one of the most spectacular views in the province. Out those windows right now, that beautiful prairie sky. I just want to begin with a single word, and that word is magic. The world of books, your world, is a world of magic. I'll go back just a few years earlier than Bruce embarrassingly referred to. I recall very clearly as a kid of 13 years of age going to the Connaught Branch Library in the Cathedral area of Regina and discovering a book that had just been published. So you can figure out the year if you know what year this book was published. It was Robertson Davies' Fifth Business. I'd been reading a lot of science fiction up to that point, Robert Heinlein and so on, and I stumbled across this book by Robertson Davies called Fifth Business, which was my introduction to adult literature, to a world of magic that I hadn't experienced, and the world of magic that many of you, of course, help people discover. I was going to use the word custodians of, but you aren't custodians. You are helpmates, people, to discover that world of magic. And the world of magic is also an intercultural world, because books are one of our main ways of coming to understand different cultures. You're on a university campus, as Bruce has mentioned, which sits on Treaty 4 land. The University of Regina also has locations on Treaty 6 land, and we want to acknowledge that fact and that presence and to help learn and each other learn from the texts of various cultures. I want to also extend the university's congratulations and best wishes to Gwen Schmidt, the new president, CEO, halftime of the Saskatchewan Library Association, and on behalf of the University of Regina, to welcome each and every one of you here. Like all of you, I'm very much looking forward to the talk of our wonderful guest speaker tonight, and I wish you the very best for your gathering, again, on behalf of the University of Regina. Thank you very much.
I guess 1971. It was 1970 for Fifth Business. I love that book. It's like it was a new view of Canada, actually, reading that book. So, born and raised in Saskatchewan, Gwen Schmidt spent a lot of time as a child in a branch of the Chinook Regional Library System. She decided in high school to become a librarian and has worked for the last 20 years at the Saskatoon Public Library, A lover of Middlemarch by George Eliot. She always has an Agatha Christie and P.G. Woodhouse novel on the go as well. So ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Saskatchewan Library Association President, Gwen Smith.
Thank you. I am actually reading Fifth Business again right now. It's in my hotel room. I'm shorter than the rest of you. Welcome, Elder Piapot. Gabrielle, welcome. Honored dignitaries and guests, members and friends. Lots of friends out there. I have been coming to the Saskatchewan Libraries Conference and the Mary Donaldson Lecture for almost 20 years. It's very surprising, but I keep coming back, and I keep coming back for two reasons every year. And one of them is for the people, and the other one is for the ideas. Every time I come, I meet new friends, and I see old friends, and I come away with two or three ideas that I can take into my work life and change my perspective. This time, I'm honored to be back as your in service as your president, and I hope that you enjoy the Mary Donaldson Lecture and that you join me afterwards for the president's reception to launch the 2015 Saskatchewan Libraries Conference. I would like us to take a moment and thank our sponsors for tonight's event. We are very pleased tonight to have the support of the First Nations University of Canada, the Saskatchewan Indian Gaming Authority, that is Painted Hand, Bear Claw, and Living Skies Casinos, Sask Culture and Sask Lotteries, and the Regina Public Library, who are sponsoring the president's reception after the lecture. We would not be able to bring you this event without their tremendous support, so thanks to them for that. Thank you all for coming, and enjoy your evening.
We're actually publishing a book on the Regina Public Library next year, so I should mention that. So one of the sponsors, we're really very thrilled to be bringing that out. And now for the main act. Passionate about diversity, leadership, and innovation, Gabrielle Scrimshaw is the first in her family to pursue a post-secondary education and to travel the globe. And she's been in 20-plus countries so far. A believer in hard work and a positive attitude, she is an inspired First Nations youth recipient, the highest honor the Indigenous community gives to its high achievers. And most recently, she co-founded a national not-for-profit Aboriginal Professionals Association and was accepted into the MBA programs at Harvard Business School and the Stanford Graduate School of Business. So this is a very high achiever. Named a young Aboriginal Canadian to watch by Huffington Post, Gabrielle was born in Saskatchewan and is a proud member of the Hatchet Lake First Nation. We are most fortunate to be able to watch her this evening. So ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our Mary Donaldson Memorial Lecturer, Gabrielle Scrimshaw.
Well, good evening, everyone. Oh, everyone here is from Saskatchewan. We can do better than that. Good evening, everyone. Right? I mean, most people are from Saskatchewan, I'm assuming. I love that Saskatchewan hospitality. Can everyone hear me okay? All right. So I am sincerely honored to be with you here this evening on Treaty 4 territory. Elder, thank you so much for that beautiful opening and for having me here this evening. It's always an honor to be able to, you know, speak in front of community leaders, influencers. Certainly, I don't get this invitation every single day, so I'm really honored to be with you here this evening. Now, people often ask me how I got to be where I am today. And they don't ask me that because I'm someone marvelously exceptional. I would actually argue most people in this room have never really heard of me before. I'm not a millionaire entrepreneur. You don't see me on Dragon's Den. I'm not a gold medalist, an Olympian. Instead, they ask me, Gabrielle, how did you get to be where you are today? Because they understand where I started from. That as an Indigenous woman who was born in Northern Canada and raised in a single-parent household, that quite frankly, the statistics of that circumstance dictate I am not supposed to be standing in front of you here today. So I want to share with you a bit about that journey, how I got from where I started from in my life, and reflect a little bit about what the statistics say where I should be, and talk about my journey of how I got to be where I am today. And that journey is one characterized by a number of leaps of faith, mentors, and like most people, a lot of mishaps. And I would argue, in fact, that it had very little to do with me and my choices. And in fact, my life has been influenced more by the decisions and choices of others. And so I want to share with you how other people's, you know, influence and choices have helped shape me to become the young woman you see standing in front of you here today, with the hope that it might inspire you to start to think about some of the everyday choices that you make and maybe a little bit of a different light. So, as Aboriginal people, our elders, they're our wisdom keepers. And an elder once told me, he's actually a Saskatchewan elder, Winston Watney. Maybe some people know Winston. And Winston once told me, he said, Gabrielle, the strength of who we are as Indigenous people comes from the fact that we speak from the heart. And that for thousands of years, we've passed down our traditional knowledge, history, and cultures through our stories. So he said, Gabrielle, tell your story. So in honoring that elder's wisdom with you here this evening, I'd like to do exactly that, share a little bit of my personal story with you. And where does every good story start? It starts at the beginning. And for me, I'm very proud to say that my beginning started right here in the province of Saskatchewan. I was actually born in LaRonge. I'm the youngest of three girls. We grew up in LaRonge until I was just a little girl, but 3 years old, and we moved down to Duck Lake, which is right between Saskatoon and Prince Albert. So I've kind of lived in small towns my entire life for the most part. And as I mentioned, I'm the youngest of three girls. My father, usually a question I get all the time when I'm back in Saskatchewan is your dad the artist? Yes. My dad's Glenn. He's the artist. He's a painter, entrepreneur. But what most people actually don't know is he was actually a commercial fisherman at one point in time in his life. He spent most of his life in sort of north and north central Saskatchewan, an avid outdoorsman. And in the mid-1980s, he was actually managing a co-op store up in northern Saskatchewan. And one day, a beautiful First Nations woman walked through the door with this big smile, big laugh. And he kind of leaned over to his colleague and was like, who's that woman? And that's how he met my mother. So my mother, is a beautiful Dene woman from Hatchet Lake, Saskatchewan. Shortly after they met, after a couple of years, they had my sister, and a couple of years after that, they had me in the late 1980s. Now, my mother is a beautiful, strong woman. And like many people in the Aboriginal community, in the First Nations community, she has had to deal directly with the legacies of the Indian residential schools. And in particular, you know, that meant a few difficult decisions and choices in her life and her parents' lives, things that even now, as a young woman, I strive to understand, but honestly can't wrap my head around. You see, when my mother was a little girl, her parents were faced with a really difficult decision. They could either send her to the residential schools, like her siblings had gone, knowing full well that she would face physical, mental, or sexual abuse, because they had seen that happen. Or they could take her, and they could hide her on the trap line, which at that time was illegal. I'm told was illegal. And so kind of stuck between two incredibly difficult places. I can't imagine being a parent and kind of between these two, because they knew that if they took her, that she wouldn't get an education. She might not be able to participate, be employed later on in life. But they took her, and they didn't send her to residential school. But that doesn't mean that she wasn't able to escape the legacies of them. In fact, you know, like many people, when you have seven generations of First Nations people put through these schools systematically over 100 years, thousands of them, that leaves very deep scars. And when my mother grew older, She started to turn to substances to start to numb some of those pains. And shortly after I was born, my father made the incredibly difficult decision to actually raise myself and my two older sisters on his own. He realized that no matter how hard he tried to sort of keep the family together, that was no longer really an option for us. And so he kind of made the decision that he was going to be a single parent. And when I think about the statistics of that circumstance, of sort of the first couple of weeks of my life, you know, in every way, I'm really not supposed to be standing in front of you here today. I was 4 times more likely to be a victim of homicide, 11 times more likely to be reported missing, 3 times more likely to be unemployed, 10 times more likely to be incarcerated. And, you know, I'm sad to say that as we grew older, you know, we had a lot of challenges, not only within our family, but also a broader community. You know, issues like substance abuse and suicide weren't uncommon themes in my household. But when I reflect back now, and I think about my early childhood, I can't help but actually remember a lot of the beauty, especially around northern Saskatchewan, you know, those lakes and days spent on the lakes learning how to fish with my dad in the steel fishing boat that my family still has to this day, this little motor, learning how to fish, learning how to fillet fish. You know, when I was a little girl, getting to skip a day of school so I could actually learn the traditional way to skin a bear. We grew up just about 1 kilometer away from the powwow grounds. So, you know, that one weekend every summer when I got to fall asleep listening to that sacred beat of the powwow drum, being able to spend time with the elders in our community. And for me, I believe that it was those moments that actually planted the roots that I needed to grow to become the young woman you see standing in front of you here today. But that doesn't mean that it was always easy. In fact, you know, as I grew older, my life started to go down a bit of a different path. And right around the age of 13, some very distinct things sort of started to shift in my life. I already mentioned my mother, you know, wasn't in the house. And as a young girl, I did struggle with that. I didn't quite understand why, if I had a bad day, I couldn't run home and you know, cry into a mother's shoulder. That was nothing, that wasn't a sensation I ever knew. And I didn't understand that. I didn't know if that was my fault. And I dealt, you know, I had a hard time dealing with that. But also, my oldest sister, Jessica, she's 10 years older than I am. She'd already moved to the city, so she wasn't really in the house anymore. My father, being the entrepreneur, you know, he was working incredibly hard to provide for our family. He was traveling all over the province. But that also meant that, you know what, when the 3 o'clock bell rang and I came home, he wasn't there, you know, some days. And on the weekends, he might be going to a show, so he was always on the road. And so for a long time, and a lot of my early days, around 13, you know, it was me and my sister, Glenda. She's two years older than me. But, you know, she dealt with that sense of abandonment and loneliness differently than I did. You know, for many years, she was my rock. And when I was 13 years old and she was 15 years old, she ran away. And not run away for a weekend and come back on Monday. She ran away and she didn't come home. You know, she dropped out of high school for a period of time and she just decided that she didn't want to live with our family anymore. And so at the age of 13, for me, myself, that meant that, you know, I felt so alone. And this led to a really dark chapter in my life when I can vividly remember being 14 years old. And you know, the house was empty like it usually was, sitting at the edge of my bed, telling myself that nobody would miss me if I was gone. Counting out the people, making a mental list, who would actually come to my funeral. I wasn't thinking about getting through the next month, I wasn't thinking about getting through the next week, I just wanted to get through the day. And it was so incredibly hard for me to find a light, for me to find something in my life worth fighting for. Because I didn't believe in myself. I didn't see anything worth fighting for. But then something happened. And it taught me the importance of what I call everyday mentorship, which is that an everyday action for you could be a life-changing moment for someone else. It was a moment by chance and completely out of my control. I was 15 years old, and a friend of a teacher, his name was Brian, he was just passing through our town, and he decided on a whim to give a presentation at my school. And so late one afternoon, all 24 of us going up into the school library, and he gave this presentation, and he was talking about places in the world. He did a lot of development work and travel in other countries, and you know, I just remember being so intrigued by his stories, and he had these coins from other parts of the world, and these tangible things from places that only, you know, read about in books, or, you know, seen on the Discovery Channel, back when it actually used to have learning programming, you know, before the days of Duck Dynasty, or whatever they have now. And so after his presentation, the bell rang, all the kids ran home. I walked up to him, I walked up to Brian, and I just wanted to talk to him about some of his travels. And I started him asking questions about, you know, the places that he'd been. And he answered my questions, but more than that, he actually asked me questions. He asked me questions about what were the places that I wanted to one day travel to. But he also asked me what are the challenges I was going through. And so it was supposed to be a 5-minute conversation, turned into about 60 minutes, the end of which I was crying. And then he said, you know, Gabrielle, I want you to know I've traveled the world, and I think you're one of the most amazing young women I've ever met. And that floored me. I was 15 years old, and those words floored me. I thought, you've met so many people, you've done so many things, like, how am I an amazing young woman? And, you know, in a way, it took me a long time to even really understand and internalize that, but I actually believe that he just planted this little seed inside of me, this small seed of, you know what? Even if I don't really believe that I might be amazing right now, if he says it, then maybe it's true. Maybe there is something worth fighting for. And I have no idea what that looks like, but maybe I owe it to myself to find out. A couple of years later, you know, he sent me a piece of mail, just a letter. And he said, Gabrielle, I want you to know I'm still thinking about you. I hope you're doing well. You're amazing. Keep going. And I think about that, it, like, for him it was just a letter, for him it was just an hour of his time, but for me, in the end of that, it meant so much more. Around the age of 17, I also received another piece of mail, but this piece of mail was from a man named Wayne. I call him Uncle Wayne, but he's actually my dad's cousin. And Wayne is famous in my family for a number of reasons. When he was just 12 years old, he kind of famously read all of the encyclopedias. Really bright guy. But he actually dropped out of grade 11, so he never finished high school. And so, you know, through many of the years of my dad and Wayne, they kind of just grew up together, getting in a lot of trouble. And, you know, shortly after I was born, we lived in a trailer park in LaRange. Sadly, Wayne's trailer actually burnt down. But in the mid-1990s, he became the first person ever accepted into the Stanford Sloan program without a high school education. If you look at the application page, they list that you have to have a bachelor's degree or international equivalent. They don't even list that you have a high school diploma because it's just an assumption. But Wayne's motto, he always used to say, you know, Gabrielle, I'm too stupid to know what I can't do. I just go for it. So people said I was crazy for applying, but he applied and he got in. And so after he finished Stanford, his program at Stanford, he was a consultant. He traveled all over the world and he used to send me little trinkets. Actually, I still have a lot of them. He sent me a little clay flute from South America that I remember trying desperately to learn different tunes on. And he sent me these striped pair of linen pants, I remember from Africa, they were from Ghana. And I wore them until they were all frayed at the bottom, they had holes everywhere. But to me, these little things were portals to other places in the world. They were tangible things from other places. And when I was 17 years old, he sent me another piece of mail. But this piece of mail was a postcard, and it was a postcard from Stanford University. So if you've ever been to Northern California and you've maybe been on the Stanford campus, they have this beautiful road, it's called Palm Drive. It's about a kilometer long. On either side of it, there's beautiful palm trees that line the road. At the end of that road, there's this beautiful grass courtyard, beautiful flower garden, and at the end of that, there's this place called Memorial Church. It's very picturesque Stanford. It's all done in sort of the Spanish architecture. It's gorgeous. And the postcard he sent me was of Memorial Church. And all he wrote on the back was, "It's all here waiting for you." I was 17 years old. I'd never traveled outside of Canada. I never dreamt in a million years of going to a good school. But I took that sticky tack, my little blue sticky tack, and I put it on the mirror where I got ready every single day. And in a way, it was a gentle encouragement for me. It was a gentle reminder of me, for me to dream. A reminder that the world was bigger than the walls of my small community. It was bigger than what I could see and feel, right? It's all here waiting for you. Shortly after I received that postcard, I actually remember telling my best friend, "I'm gonna go to Harvard one day." And she laughed at me, and it wasn't out of malice, she wasn't being mean, but it was just like, it just sounded so ridiculous, like somebody from a little town would actually one day maybe go to one of these schools. But I remember just kind of saying that, I kind of declare that I want to go to a good school. And when I think about those moments, when I reflect on Brian, when I reflect on Wayne, I mean, for them, it was literally a 50-cent stamp and a postcard, an hour of their time. But to me, on the end of that, it meant so much more. It gave me hope. It gave me a sense of purpose. It gave me a seed that over time, you know, was nourished into something that was so much bigger. And it taught me that, you know, you should never underestimate the value of a few moments of your time. An everyday action for you could be a life-changing moment for someone else. And so after, you know, I got those pieces of mail, I started to focus a little bit more on my schoolwork, get more involved, and, you know, finished my high school in Duck Lake. Now, in an interesting way, though, I would actually say my life really started shortly after, right about when I was finishing high school. And it started on a very specific day, which was March 21st, 2006. Because that was the day that my little nephew, Ethan, was born. And what I remember so vividly about holding my nephew for the very first time was feeling so overwhelmed with this kind of love that I'd never felt before in my life. That unconditional love of just holding a little newborn child. I'm gonna be honest with you, when I was growing up, I was super awkward around kids. I was never the girl you wanted to babysit your children. But I remember holding Ethan and just feeling so natural, feeling so comfortable. And in that moment of pure love, of pure joy and happiness, I was overcome with a sense of sadness. Because I realized that, you know, although this little baby boy was born only hours before, that because of who he was, being a young First Nations child, that he would have to grow up facing some very daunting circumstances, not unlike the ones that my family and my community had had to face growing up. And I just couldn't fathom that. That before this little child had the opportunity to make his first choice in life, that so much of his life was already made up for him. Now, since that day holding Ethan in the hospital, I'm very fortunate to say that I've had two other little motivators come into my life, Sydney and Quade. Now, they're not my children. They're the children of my older sisters. Sydney is Ethan's little sister. She's 5 years old. She's about to celebrate her 6th birthday. Ethan's now 9 years old. He just had his Nerf gun-themed party. He's kind of gone through all the stages you think a 9-year-old boy would go through. He was like really into Minecraft and like Bumblebee, Batman, Spider-Man. And Quade, I call him the best birthday gift I ever received. Because just over 2 years ago, he was born on my birthday. He's the first son of my eldest sister, Jessica. And I told her too, and her due date was like March 21st. I'm like, nope. March 27th, it's gonna happen, March 27th. And sure enough, March 27th, just over 2 years ago, Quade was born. And I mean, these kids are probably like most children you know, right? They're just full of energy and life, and they like getting one another in trouble and blaming and playing with the kids outside. But I'm sad to say that because they're First Nations, that they're gonna have to face some really daunting circumstances. You know, Ethan, if he goes to school on reserve, he's more likely to drop out of high school than he is to finish it. Now, should he decide to go off reserve into the provincial system, his chances are only a little bit better, or about 4 out of 10 Aboriginal people drop out. Now, should he decide to try to, you know, focus on his schooling, on his educational journey, he's going to be funded anywhere from 30 to 40% less than if he were non-First Nations. Sydney, little five-year-old Sydney, because she's a First Nations woman, she is four times more likely to be a victim of homicide. She's 11 times more likely to be reported missing in this country. Now, as the rate of homicide for in Canada has trended down over the last three decades, for Aboriginal women, it is on the rise. So as Sydney grows older, she is more and more likely to be a victim of homicide. These kids are three times more likely to be unemployed, 10 times more likely to be incarcerated. In the province of Saskatchewan, half of First Nations children live in poverty. And when I think about these kids, and I see how full of life and how full of love and how innocent they are, I just can't understand that. That's their circumstance. But holding Ethan in the hospital that day, I had a realization. And that was simply that, you know, like most children, like most kids, this little guy doesn't have a say in the world that he's about to grow up in. But I realized that I do have a say in the world that he's going to grow up in. So holding Ethan in the hospital that day, I made him a silent promise, which was that no matter how scared I was, uncertain I was of myself, I promised him that I would live each day, view each decision, each interaction as an opportunity to make his life better. And so armed with this conviction, I'm going to be honest with you, it still took me time to be able to, you know, find my footing. I've never really considered myself to be a leader. That was never a term I ever felt comfortable with. You know, it took me a long time to even be able to find my confidence. But after Ethan was born, I enrolled at the University of Saskatchewan in the Bachelor of Commerce program. I wanted to major in marketing. And, you know, people ask me actually why I went, because I was the first person in my family to sort of decide that that's something I wanted to do, this post-secondary was something I wanted to do. And, you know, for me, I reflect on my dad. And my dad, if you know him, he's a very principled man. I'm very lucky that he raised us on principles of respect, of love, of community. And for my dad, sort of choosing a non-traditional path himself, being an artist, he said, you know, Gabrielle, if you're happy, I'm happy for you. Do what you want to do. You know, do right by others, work hard, and that's all I can ask of you. He gave me the tools, and he kind of pushed me out into the world, and he said, do what you want to do. So for me, I didn't know actually what I wanted to do, so I thought, you know, maybe an education might help me figure that out. And the very first day I stepped onto that campus, I honestly had no idea how transformative an experience I was in for. You know, the first day I stepped onto that campus, if I could just turn back time, I'd just give myself a hug. Because I was so uncertain, I was so scared. I thought I was going to fail. I didn't know, you know, if I would succeed. I didn't know where any of it was going. I thought I was going to end up out of school, in debt, you know, and just kind of in the same place, but maybe even worse. But I thought, you know what, I'm just going to give it a try. That's all I promised myself, that I would give it a try. And, you know, I started to get a little bit more involved. I started to, you know, I found another mentor. I didn't want to leave my mentors up to chance like I kind of had the first couple of ones. And in university, actually, is when my dream of traveling started to become a reality. And one country magically turned into over 18 countries. And in the span of those 4 years, I traveled to, like I said, over 18 countries. And I had a lot of amazing memories. I was really fortunate. And you know, as you travel, as you start to go different places, your worldview starts to expand. You start to think about things differently, see the world a little bit more differently, through different people's lenses, you start to empathize and understand a little bit more. And that absolutely, for me, was what happened. And some of my fondest memories were actually working with Indigenous groups on many of the world's different continents. You know, getting to see and meet with the Aboriginal people in Australia or the Maori people in New Zealand, building an Indigenous community center in northern Peru. And it was through those interactions that I realized two things. Now, the first was the strength in our community, the beauty and the culture of our communities, and just seeing that kind of resiliency, that culture that has lasted thousands of years, and it made me incredibly proud of who I am, and it made me want to learn more about myself as a young Dene woman. The second thing I realized was that there were actually a lot of misconceptions that people had about who we as Indigenous people are. You see, myself kind of growing up in and around the community my entire life, I always felt that love. I always felt and saw that and heard that laughter. And so when I moved to the city and then I started to travel around the world, I realized very quickly that not everyone saw that beauty. Not everyone heard that laughter in the way that I did when they thought of the Aboriginal community. In fact, in one particular vivid moment, happened right here in the city of Regina. I was 19 years old. It was the summer between my first and second year of university. I just had a job, I was working downtown. And I was new to the city, I didn't know many people. And there was a group of about 10 of us, kind of just socializing, getting to know one another. And there was this one young gentleman, late one evening, and he was telling us how his father was an RCMP officer, his uncle was an RCMP officer, and his brother was an RCMP officer. And wouldn't you know it, he was in the process of applying to become an RCMP officer. But what he said next are words that will stay with me for the rest of my life. He said, "I can't wait to become a police officer so I can go out and shoot some effing Indians." In a group of about 10 people, about half of them knew that I'm First Nations, and no one said anything. But when I reflect on that moment, I actually think the bigger injustice was that I didn't say anything. In fact, I let his words have power over me, to the point where I remember feeling ashamed of myself, that I was who I was, that he thought I was worth shooting. I internalized his words. And I also remember thinking, I didn't want to cause a commotion. I didn't want to be rude. I didn't want to say anything, make anyone uncomfortable. So I let it slide. But in truth, I actually didn't let it slide because I carried that moment with me. I carried the weight of that moment. You know, a week went by, and then a month went by. And I remember telling my oldest sister, Jessica, about a month later, what had happened. And Jessica, in my family, she is the diplomat. She's the calm, cool, level-headed one. And she got mad at me. She yelled at me. She said, "Gabrielle, why didn't you say anything?" And when I couldn't come up with a good enough answer, she said, "Gabrielle, who cares about you? What if that guy does go and become an RCMP officer? And the native he grows up to one day shoot is Ethan." I remember sitting there so still and just feeling the breath come out of my lungs, like I was winded by that thought. Because out of all the ways I had thought about it, I had never thought about it in that way. You know, that something I could have said and done could have changed his life. And I'd always thought about how my actions have consequences in terms of the things that I say. But I never really fully understood that if I don't say anything, if I don't do anything, then that also has a consequence. And so in that moment, I made myself a promise, which was that no matter how uncomfortable it made me, that in a moment where I heard something that was maybe misinformed, in a moment where I saw injustice in the world, that I would summon my courage to say something. I would summon my courage to do something. Not saying that every time I did that or every time I said something that it would somehow change the world. But I just thought, you know what? I need to stand up for what I believe is right. I realized that if I lived my entire life waiting for someone else to say something, waiting for someone else to do something, I might spend my entire life on the sidelines and nothing might change. So I made myself that promise. And so after that moment, I went back to the university and you know, I really tried hard. I was studying, and I ended up, becoming the first person in my family to get a post-secondary education. I wasn't the last. Actually, my sisters both went. My sister Glenda ended up going back to school after she had Ethan. She's now a teacher. She has an education degree. My other sister Jessica is now in the process of becoming a nurse. So I went back to the University of Saskatchewan, ended up finishing in the top 5% of my college, worked incredibly hard to do that. And so at the end of university, you know, like most graduates kind of come to that moment, I ended up deciding to move to the city of Toronto to work in finance. So for those of you in this room who've ever purchased a one-way ticket, you know how daunting that experience can be. And I felt scared. This was only 5 years ago. And people asked me why I did it, and the reason was, I guess, twofold. So first was professional. I was offered a great position at the Royal Bank of Canada in something called the Graduate Leadership Program. It's one of the most competitive postgraduate programs in the country for finance people. Every year, less than 1% roughly of people who apply get in. To get in, you need a master's, like an MBA, and you need 3 to 5 years work experience. I didn't have any of those things. But a recruiter at RBC decided to take a chance. They, as an organization, value diversity. And so I said, you know, if they're going to take a chance on me, I'll take a chance, and I'll move. I knew it was a great professional opportunity. I wanted to dive into the deep end and just see if I would swim. Now, the second reason why I moved to Toronto had to do with the promises that I had made to both Ethan and myself. And that was because in the greater Toronto area, they have about 80% of Canada's head offices. But less than 0.8% of those in leadership roles identify as Aboriginal. So instead of me thinking of, you know, leaving my community, I wanted to be an ambassador for my community. I wanted to earn a seat at the table, you know, and provide a voice for Indigenous people. I wanted to change the dialogue that I was hearing between Native and non-Native people. And so shortly after moving to Toronto, about 6 months after, actually, I realized that there was a gap for Indigenous professionals, Indigenous leaders. And so sort of feeling that myself and talking to others as I was connecting with other Native leaders in the city, I realized that there was a lack of network, lack of opportunity available. So we had an idea to start a Native Professional Association. 6 months after that, we launched, and about 4 months after that, we incorporated as a not-for-profit in early 2012. Now, that organization is one that is so near and dear to my heart. I've learned a tremendous amount about leadership. I've learned a tremendous amount about myself and my capabilities. But I've also learned a lot about the Aboriginal community. We now have over 700 Indigenous professional members across Canada. And through my role as the co-founder and president, I'm able to travel across this country. And I've been able to meet with incredible and resilient Indigenous leaders in this country. And it's because of that work that I actually think we're at an exciting time as a country. We are at the precipice of something that I believe is very special. I like to say the tides are shifting. And I believe that the Indigenous people are a big part of that story. And why do I say that? Well, I mean, things are starting to change. Now, sometimes we say the word Aboriginal, we sort of forget what it means. Aboriginal, you know, encompasses First Nations, Métis, Inuit cultures. Then that First Nations group, there are over 50 different linguistic groups. Language is the root of culture. There are over 600 First Nations communities across Canada. And so just like we wouldn't go to Europe and expect to do business the same with the English, as the Italians, as the French, you know, we can't have a one-size-fits-all approach for the Aboriginal community, the incredibly diverse community of Aboriginal people in this country. But we're also growing. I'm sure some of you maybe heard that the Aboriginal population is growing. In Canada today, just over 1.4 million people identify as Aboriginal. That's just over 4% of the Canadian population. But what's incredible about that is in 2006, the government of Canada put out this research and they said the Aboriginal population will only hit over 4% by the year 2017. We hit that number in 2011, 6 years ahead of schedule. We're growing at 4 times the rate of the non-Indigenous population. That's to do with two things mainly. The first is higher birth rate. Aboriginal women tend to have larger families at a younger age. But the second is higher rates of self-identification. It wasn't that long ago, and I've talked to a lot of people who say, you know, their parents didn't feel comfortable identifying as Aboriginal, even though that was in their veins. And so now we're seeing more and more people, you know, stand firm, stand up tall, and say, I am an Aboriginal person. The Aboriginal community is also very young. Half of the Aboriginal population in this country are under the age of 28. Now, if we can compare that to sort of the makeup of the broader population, where we have the largest segment being sort of the baby boomers, half of the Aboriginal population is under the age of 28. 3 out of 10 are under the age of 14. So you put that together with the growth rate, it means that Aboriginal youth are the fastest growing demographic in our country today. Now, we're also increasingly more urban, we're increasingly more educated. Half of the Aboriginal community in Canada lives in urban centres. If you ask them why they go there, it's usually the same answer anyone would give you. In fact, I moved for a job, or for an employment opportunity, or I moved to get an education. We're also seeing, like I said, education rates. I think it's very special that this is the venue for this lecture this evening, the First Nations University of Canada. In fact, I watched a CBC documentary from a few years back called Eighth Fire, which a young student from this university was giving an interview, and she was talking about how her grandmother, an elder in the community, had said education is the new buffalo for Aboriginal people. How beautiful is that? I get goosebumps when I think about that. Education is the new buffalo for Aboriginal people. Because for thousands of years, buffalo had provided every form of sustenance for Aboriginal people. Heat, food, shelter, everything you needed to survive. Education is the new buffalo. So we're starting to see these shifts happen in our community. I remember I did a talk actually in Saskatoon, and I talked to some students after, about 17-year-old students, and I asked them, you know, what do you want to do with your life? What are some of your hopes and aspirations? And this young woman said, well, I'm an activist, and so I want to be a lawyer so I can work for our community. And I just think about that, like I get goosebumps again, because I'm like, wow, if the 17-year-olds of our world are saying, I am an activist and I want to work for our community, I feel like we're in great hands. Because when I was 17 years old, I didn't feel confident enough to state myself as an activist. And so the tides are shifting. In fact, by the year 2026, roughly 400,000 Indigenous youth are going to enter the workforce in Canada. But what we have to also understand is that, you know, these youth, if things stay the way they are set to face an incredible amount of challenges, these statistics that I've been talking about. And I would argue that in a country like Canada today, a country where we hold our values so high, we paint that flag on our backpacks and we travel the world and we wear it so proudly, that in a country like Canada, we should really live by the values we hold so dear and be a country where every child, regardless of who they are or where they're from, has an equal opportunity to reach their full and beautiful potential. But the truth is, there's actually a business case to this as well, that if we were to close all these gaps that I'm talking about, the skills and education gap, that would add an estimated $500 billion to the Canadian economy over a 25-year period. That's enough money to put every post-secondary student in Canada through post-secondary education for the next 13 years. But we're missing out on this opportunity if we do nothing. I think now is the time for us to have these conversations. We have an aging baby boomer population. We have skill shortages across the country in different pockets of our economies. And at the same time, we have a growing young and vibrant Indigenous population. So I think the time is now, because we need to have these conversations today, not in 10 years from now. Because the year 2026, it's only 11 years from now, the window of time we have is slowly closing. And the year 2026, if I'm being perfectly honest, is also special to me for another reason. Because that's the year Ethan will celebrate his 20th birthday and will be about to start his adult life. That's my end game. I never want him to face the kinds of things I had to face growing up. I want him to feel loved, to believe he can be anything he wants to be and do anything he wants to do. And just as importantly, wake up every single day and be proud of who he is as a young Dene person. Now, my dream for Ethan's lifetime, I believe, is something that's well within our reach, but it's up to you and I to have the tough conversations and the courage to ask questions about how this is the Canada we live in and how can we do better. So you might be asking yourselves, what are some of the things that I can do? I would argue that every conversation counts. In a country where even today, 50% of non-Aboriginal people have never heard of residential schools, we have a lot of learning to do as a country. So every conversation counts. You know, in Ontario, one in five non-Aboriginal Ontario, people in Ontario would not want an Aboriginal person living next door, moving in next door. In the prairies, that number is as high as 1 in 3. 1/3 of Canadians believe that Aboriginal people are mostly to blame for their current economic circumstance. Every conversation we have counts. That's around your boardroom tables, but I would argue just as importantly, around your dinner tables. You know, I think it's really important that we start to learn and understand. If you don't know, ask questions. Google is an amazing resource. What's the traditional territory that you're standing on? Is there a treaty area? You know, who looked after this land long before it was ever called Canada or Kanata or Regina, right? Get to know the land you're standing on and the people who cared for it. Now, just to wrap up, I want to leave you with three main thoughts based on my talk today. Now, actually, just to wrap up a little bit about what I'm doing now, as mentioned, I mean, the last year of my life has been a bit of a roller coaster. I'm not going to lie. Actually, I was working at the Royal Bank of Canada. Things were going really well for me there. Just over a year ago, I took a leap of faith and I resigned my role. And the last year has been amazing being able to run the Aboriginal Professional Association of Canada. A lot of high highs and a lot of low lows. But I also, you know, remembering that postcard that I had on my mirror when I was 17 years old, I decided to pursue my dream of, you know, getting some type of higher education. And as it was mentioned, I'm really proud to say that just 5 months ago, I was accepted into the MBA programs at both Harvard and Stanford University. Now, the big question everyone asks is, which one did you choose? Well, I ended up, just 2 months ago, I decided to go to Stanford. So I'm really happy that coming this fall, I'll be living in Northern California, studying my MBA. Yeah, the weather's a little bit better there. And I mean, if you would have told me, honestly, 10 years ago, when I was living in a town of 800 people, when I spent my summers scooping ice cream and cutting grass, that in 10 years I would be offered, you know, full ride scholarships totaling nearly $500,000 to two of the best universities in the world, I would have said you were crazy. I would have said you were nuts. But that's what happens when you're willing to work hard and take chances, but more importantly, be surrounded by people who support you and dare you to dream. Now, I've shared a few stories from my own life, and if I could wrap it up into three main thoughts, they would be this. The first is, never underestimate the value of a few moments of your time. An everyday action for you, I promise, can be a life-changing moment for someone else. The second is, remember what you say, but just as importantly, what you don't say matters. And in those moments where it might make you uncomfortable, I encourage you to stand up for what you believe is right. If you hear something that might be misinformed. And if you don't feel, you know, like you know enough, go out and seek that knowledge. The third thing I'll leave you with is that Canada's workforce and overall population is changing. And the Aboriginal people are a big part of that story. But I actually think that that's an exciting thing for our country. It's an opportunity for us to get it right and lead by example for the rest of the world. Now, I started with an elder story, and I'd like to end with an elder story. Now, it's an elder I work with a lot in Toronto. He was sharing with me how, on this sunny winter afternoon, he was teaching his little son about, he was about 4 years old, he was teaching him about traditional medicine. So they were out in the bush in the deep snow, you know, all day, trudging through that snow. And as they were walking, trudging through that deep snow, his little son slowly started to follow behind him. And as they were walking, his son said, "Dad, it's a lot easier for me to step where you've stepped." Each day, every one of us is carving a path. We're creating footprints for other people to follow in. The elder also told me, he said, "Gabrielle, make sure when you walk that you walk in a good way, whatever that means to you." To me, that means doing everything I do with excellence and integrity. I've never been the smartest person in any room, you know, but I just always want to do my best and do so with integrity. Now, I stand before you, a young woman who in so many ways is just not supposed to be here. But when I reflect on my journey, I see it has a lot to do with the footprints I've been able to follow in. You know, 12 years ago, a man named Brian told a young Indigenous girl he believed in her. 10 years ago, a man named Wayne sent that same girl a postcard. 5 years ago, a recruiter at RBC took a chance and they didn't have to. But it's also had to do with the footprints that I've been encouraged to make on my own. You know, at the right point in time, I received the support and encouragement to veer off and dare to create my own path. You know, 9 years ago, I decided to attend post-secondary education. 5 years ago, I bought a one-way ticket. And a year ago, I decided to take a leap into the unknown, pursue a vision I thought was worth fighting for, and a dream I thought I'd never have a grasp over. And it's through these footprints that I am standing in front of you here this evening. And so as you go forward, you're thinking about your circles of influence, and you're thinking about your work and your communities, I want you to ask yourselves two questions and two questions only, which are, what are the footprints that I'm leaving, and how can I walk in a good way? So with that, I'd like to say thank you, Masi. Thanks so much for having me.